Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom, from a potentially stormy Central Florida. Yes, our weather here is not perfect. If you've thought differently, you know, be informed. Don't be disillusioned if you come down here. But we hope all of you are having a wonderful Sabbath. This has been a significant couple of weeks. Historically, a lot of commemorations taking place around the world, in the Bahamas, in Northern Ireland, in France. And on the 20th of this month, Colombia will be independent for a certain number of years, Colombia and South America, but also Americans will be commemorating, I think it's what, the 45th? Anniversary? I think so. Not quite. Is it the 45th? From 1969? Yeah. Maybe it's the 46th, I guess. The 46th anniversary, right? From 1969 till the present. Remember July 20th, 1969? Were you alive at that time? Some of you were not. I hope, frankly, that some of you are young enough to say you were not alive. You know, I know that's the case for some of you, frankly, but many of you were alive. And remember the first human beings who set foot on the moon, and they were Americans. So Americans should remember July 20th when it comes around from year to year. Quite an achievement for the human race. Unfortunately, here on Earth, we continue to have our many, many problems with human nature, as we call it. And you know, it's interesting, these recent days, the weather today is somewhat turbulent, and there's been a turbulent climate in the world in recent weeks. A tragic in many ways. There's been violence. There's been also even verbal violence, invective. We can't just disagree. We can't just say, I think you're misinformed. I think you've overstated your case. No, we attack, you know, verbally nowadays, it seems. We can't have civil discourse, and then beyond that, we have, unfortunately, right now, a very violent world. We also have, as we understand, a breaking down of standards that does not bode well, this breakdown for the future of our society, for the stability of our society. At a time like this, we have to be concerned that we, whoever's listening to me now, that we are maintaining the standards that we understand. That we are maintaining our relationship to God and to His Word at a time like this. Today I'm talking about, I'm giving you ministerial comments about a monumental conflict. Ministerial comments about a monumental conflict. You know, when I first thought of that title, I was thinking of an ancient civil war. But you know what? There's a double entendre there that I came to see. There's a monumental conflict taking place right now in the world as well. That kind of relates, of course, that directly relates to the conflict I'm talking about, the historical conflict I'm talking about. So first let me go to Matthew 7. Matthew 7 and verse 13. Enter into the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. 14, verse 14, because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. Talking about eternal life, yes, very few who find it. Many just go with the flow. Most people will tend to go with the flow. So if we're living in a fairly conservative age, and there have been some in certain areas at certain times, if we're living in a relatively conservative age, people go along with that. It pervades the environment and people go along with it. On the other hand, if standards begin to decline, then people tend to go along with that. So people tend to, as I often say, go with the flow. But then there are others who take the time to evaluate where they stand and why. And of course, God has selected certain people and opened their minds and hearts to be a part of his first fruits, those whom he selects out of the vast sea of humanity to help the rest of humankind on this road to eternal life. They are going to be kings and priests and judges in the world tomorrow, the awesome age ahead, the millennium, the messianic age. They're going to be there with Jesus Christ. Most of the public just tends to go with whatever the prevailing dominant cultural norms are. And right now, unfortunately, we're living in a time which seemingly is a time of breakdown of standards and of increasing both violent rhetoric and even violent acts. We have to be then very, very careful to maintain proper standards and to, you know, remember what our responsibilities are and what our future is. We talked about the Apostle Paul for 3 weeks. We had a series on Galatians, and I quoted often from the Apostle Paul, from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin is a very important tribe. Jacob loved Rachel. He had two children by Rachel, Joseph the firstborn by Rachel, and then Benjamin. Son of my right hand, Benjamin, who was born in the land of Canaan, the only son born in the land of Canaan, which was to the south of Syria, so it was to the right. You know, in the Middle East, you face east, so the south is on your right. So Benjamin was the son of the right, son of the south, son of the right. And the last of the sons to be born, and was very important in Jacob's thinking. And Benjamin has had an interesting role to play historically. As I said, the Apostle Paul came from Benjamin. But there was a time when Israel lapsed into very, very serious misbehavior, and unfortunately it particularly afflicted the tribe of Benjamin, to the point where a civil war developed between Benjamin and the other tribes, a monumental conflict that nearly wiped out, nearly exterminated one of the tribes of Israel. There wouldn't have been any Benjamites to produce Mordecai in later history, to produce Paul in later history. They wouldn't have been there, other than for the events I'm going to talk about today. Now, civil war is the most tragic of wars. Wars among friends, wars among relatives, sometimes even between parents and children, between brother and brother. I'm always moved when I go to the Disney theme parks and see the Disney displays about the American Civil War, the war between the states. There's a very moving section of slides and music. Two brothers on their way, one more blue and one more gray. I don't think I can watch it without tearing up every time I see it. Civil wars are very, very tragic. In Spain, in the 1930s, there was a terrible civil war. It took many, many lives. It's interesting. The Brits, the British had the War of the Roses, and then they had the Puritan Cavalier War, and then the troublemakers left and came here. And so we had our own civil war here. I wasn't around. My ancestors weren't around. My wife's were. There was a civil war here. The British haven't had a civil war since the Americans left. But the Americans had a very bloody, really the first of the modern wars was the American Civil War. It really kind of prepared the way for the First World War in terms of the technology and tactics. And was our costliest war, I believe, was the American Civil War, which is also called the War Between the States. We've been recently commemorating the 150th anniversary of that war. Well, I want to go back many, many centuries into the history of ancient Israel to a monumental conflict of ancient times, as I said, that nearly took the life of one of the existence away of one of the tribes of Israel. The time of the judges, ladies and gentlemen, is a time I think about often when I look at what's going on today in the world, because I believe the time of the judges was a chaotic period, and a period of breaking down of standards, and in many ways resembles the situation we have now. So we have to be careful, because a lot of bizarre behavior can come to be justified if we're not careful. It is amazing what people can rationalize and wind up either allowing or even encouraging if we are cut loose from basic standards such as are found in the Bible. And this is what was happening in ancient Israel. Now, at first, there was great leadership, Moses, Joshua, and even those after Joshua. But eventually, after being in the land for a period of time, the Israelites began to drift away from what was from the covenant that they had made with their God. And I want to go to Judges 2. Now, the book of the Judges talks about a time in Israel when there was not a united central government to control things. So Israel functioned without a monarch for a period of time and didn't do so well. Then they had a monarchy and didn't do so well either. So the form of government didn't seem to matter. Israelites failed either way. To use an athletic analogy, they fumbled the ball. You know, whoever was the coach or whatever the form of coaching was, direction was, they fumbled the ball in either case. But at the time of the Judges, there was not a central monarch such as was later. But they had originally a very powerful leader in Moses and then in Joshua, and then elders ruled after Joshua. I want to go to Judges 2 and verse 11. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served the Baals, the Baals, the various Baalim, right, the various gods and goddesses of the region. Judges 2:11. The book of the Judges, to some degree, is not entirely chronological. To some degree, the material is based on theme, connecting with later material in the Bible. So there is material at the end of the book that really is chronologically in the early part of the Judges period. The 17th chapter happened early because we have the grandson of Moses there. And then the 18th chapter happens at the time of the grandson of Moses. Then the 19th chapter through the 21st is a civil war which takes place while the high priest Phinehas is still alive. And remember, he was there in the wilderness time. He was there before they entered the promised land. So I'm guessing, this is kind of a guess, that the period I'm going to read to you about was perhaps 30 years into the period that we're talking about. You know, maybe around 1370 or so BC, is the period we're talking about. Because Phinehas was probably very old, but still alive. And God was still speaking to the Israelites through the high priest Phinehas. Is everybody all right? So we're talking about early in the period, before the first great judge, I believe, arose from the tribe of Judah that we can read about later on in the book of Judges. Well, he's mentioned in Judges, the third chapter. Othniel. So Othniel occurs in chapter 3 of Judges. I believe that what I'm going to read to you about today is before the time of Othniel. I go now to Judges 2:11, as I began to. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served the Baals, and they forsook the Eternal God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Eternal to anger. They forsook the Eternal and served Baal and the Ashtoreths, you know, goddesses, gods and goddesses. And this leads to all kinds of corrupt behavior. And the anger of the Eternal was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Eternal was against them for calamity, as the Eternal had said, and as the Eternal had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. But as you keep reading, God would deliver them from time to time through judges. So this was the period, the turbulent period of the judges, three centuries or so of ups and downs because of the spiritual problems that people were having. Now the period begins, the early part of the period, as Israel was beginning to decline, came to the point where there was a virtual civil war that nearly destroyed one of the tribes, and that's what I want to talk about today. And it begins, and I want to first go to Judges 17:6, which is an important theme of the book. As I said, whatever the form of government Israel had, it did not succeed because the people, individual by individual, family by family, clan by clan, tribe by tribe, region by region, were not loyal to the covenant. Judges 17:6. In those days, there was no king in Israel, Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We're almost at that. We're at that point now in many ways culturally in the world today. As you know, organized religion today is not widely respected, and for good reason. But what does that mean? That means people are in effect building up their own, you know, their own set of do's and don'ts, in a sense, their own values in many ways. We are living in a very anarchic period. It's in a sense, as I said, there's a breakdown of standards. And therefore, some people are going in very bizarre directions. And there's all kinds of things out there. And all of you I know have been exposed to many of these things because you're on the internet, most of you. You know, you have devices and you can look out there and see what's there. And the more you look into some various religions and cults and groups that are out there, it's just incredible the kind of ideas that are floating around and the kind of things that are being done. Now, I have been watching the news since I was a little boy. And I realized probably in years gone by, horrible things were happening that were not reported because people thought this isn't really the kind of thing we should talk about. But even allowing for that, the kind of things that, you know, for example, when children today watch the news with their parents, if they do that together, probably they're just all, you know, individually looking at their phones. But if children are watching the news with their parents, imagine what they're being exposed to. Anyway, we're now in Judges 19. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel. See, once again, that theme is there. That there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away with him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there for 4 whole months. So we already start out with a rather sordid tale. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. Okay, so now we have a reconciliation. But she was a concubine, not a full wife. So she had a kind of subservient status, but he still had obligations towards her and she towards him. And he went back to get her, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. So now he gets to see his in-law, father-in-law. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days, so they ate and drank and lodged there. So the father evidently wanted him to stay, didn't want to part with his daughter. That's understandable. I guess he had somehow, the family had decided that she was going to be sold into this concubinage. But nevertheless, there still was a family love there, an affection there, and he didn't want her to, you know, quickly leave and go back to her husband way up north, you know. Then it came to pass on the fourth day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread and afterward go your way, you know, kind of extending it, delaying it. And I know some of us are that way when we have relatives and close friends. We want to find excuses for them to stay longer. So they sat down, and the two of them ate and drank together. Then the young woman's father said to the man, please be content to stay all night and let your heart be merry. And when the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. So he's dragging this on. Then he arose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart, but the young woman's father said, please refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. Well, now it's getting late, and he finally draws a line and says, I'm leaving. But that means he's now going to have to spend the night somewhere on the way. So where's he going to go? And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father said to him, look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow go your way so that you may get home early, so that you may get home. However, the man was not willing to spend that night. So he rose and departed. And this is where the trouble starts. You know, he left too late, couldn't get very far. You know, he was in Bethlehem. He just got as far as Jerusalem today. And, you know, just he went from the suburbs into the city, you could say. And unfortunately, this was the mistake. So it was a kind of a happenstance that caused it, if you want to look at it that way. However, the man was not willing to spend the night, so he departed. He rose and departed and came to opposite of Jebus, that is Jerusalem. Now, at that time, the Israelites had conquered it, but they had they hadn't held on to it. It had been repopulated with Canaanites and once again eventually came to be dominated by them again. Even though Israel had taken it, They lost it again, and so eventually it was conquered by David, as you know, and became his capital, Jerusalem, Yerushalayim. You know, Jerusalem, D.C., Jerusalem, David's capital. So Jerusalem became David's capital, but the Israelites did it, again, spiritually speaking, they should have seen the importance. I mean, geopolitically speaking, they should have seen the importance of that location. But for whatever reason, they didn't hold on to it. And so it had been Canaanite, and it was Canaanite again at this point. Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with him were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, "Come, please, and turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah." So he felt it's much better for us to be with our own kind. So we need to go on to Gibeah. This was very close, but further north, and it was part of the territory of Benjamin. That was really, to him, a more logical place to go rather than with foreigners. That was a very, we'll see how that worked out. So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah." And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go into lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, I'm in verse 15. And he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Well, how do you like that? We need to go to our own kind, right? We need to go to our fellow Israelites. So there he is with no place to stay. Nobody would give them a place to stay. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, where the men of the place were Benjamites. So at least this is even more so one of his own kind. So this person, had compassion on him. He was even more so one of his kinfolk, you could say, countrymen. When he raised his eyes, or his fellow tribesmen, put it that way, and when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" So he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I'm going to the house of the Eternal." So on his way, evidently, he planned to stop at Shiloh, which was in Ephraim. That was where the tabernacle was at that time. "But there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant and for the young man who is with your servant, there's no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be with you." I'm in verse 20. "However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." Ah, finally, the traditional Middle Eastern hospitality. So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. The traditional act of hospitality and service, the washing of the feet. As they were enjoying themselves, verse 22 now. And this is, remember, the territory of Benjamin, an Israelite city. "And as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men," it says in the margin. My margin says, sons of Belial. Men of no worth, right? Biblical SOBs, sons of Belial. "Certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door." Now, see this act too? Now, what does this remind you of? As you keep reading, it's going to remind you of Sodom and Gomorrah. "Then they spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, 'Bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally.' But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage.'" So very much like Lot, right? With the Sodom and Gomorrah, and with what happened with Lot way back when. "Look, here is my," then this is very sad. "Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." Now, is that the solution? But in that culture at that time, that was the solution. So you begin to see already the nature of the times that they were living in, and the state of law and order at that time, the state of civilization at that time. And yet, this is still within the lifetime of Phineas. So it's a tremendously tragic story to read, but it's here in the Bible. But the man would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. Now, if you read the next chapter, which I'm not planning to read today, I hope you will. But when you read the next chapter, you'll see that he feared for his life. He thought that if he didn't go out to them, they were going to come kill him. And maybe even if he did go out to them, he may not come out alive. He told the people later that he thought his life was, he was going to lose his life. So in one sense, he said better they should, you know, sexually abuse her than kill me. Besides sexually abusing me, they're going to probably wind up killing me. Or if I don't let them do it, then they will kill me for sure. But the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine and brought her to them. Verse 25, I'm still there. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Now, this ultimately killed her. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where his master was till it was light. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us be going." Now, I suppose that there's a lot that's not said about this. But still, I think the point that the writer is trying to bring out here is that he did not really have proper concern for her. I mean, is this how you handle things? You sort of stay in to the last minute and don't check on her, don't try to find out if there's any way you can maybe sneak out and see how she's doing or whatever. He seems to just have left her alone, closed the door, left her alone, and now that it's daylight, he comes out, get up and let us be going. You know, as I said, I imagine there are some things left out, but I think the point being brought out here was that just the attitude of people in that day and time, or at least the people that we're dealing with here in the account. Get up and let us be going, but there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. So here he brings her corpse back to his home area. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine, divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. So what he was trying to do was sensationalize the situation, get them to respond, and to vividly bring out to them what the horrible act that had occurred. This is how he did it. To each of the tribes, he sent a piece of that corpse. And so it was that all who saw it said, "No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." So finally, after a period of time where there had been evidently a lot of moral decay, finally a heinous act occurs that finally it's the last straw. And we're going to see, you know, we'll see what happens in the world, in the Western world. At some point, we're going to see such a loss of standards that there may very well be a very extreme pushback. And when it comes, it's not going to be a balanced pushback, very likely. This was not a balanced pushback, as you'll see. Now, it was true that the tribe of Benjamin did need to be punished for this, if they did not give up the criminals and let them be punished. I mean, they could have done that. There were criminals in the city of Gibeah. The ones responsible should have been punished. Those Gibeonites who abused that woman, leading to her death, should have, and wanted to attack that man, sexually assault him, they should have been punished. Chapter 20, I'm not going to read. But let me just summarize then. So the tribes of Israel did get together in Mitzpah, around the middle of the country, in Judah, and they gathered together, and they did have the high priest there with them, Phineas, who was still alive. And they did decide, and they did organize in order to first get the criminals taken care of. But the Benjamites wouldn't give them up. They rallied together, circled the wagons, as we say, and the Benjamites decided, "We're going to stick with our people. They're not going to be executed," and decided to defend them and go to war with the other tribes. Isn't that incredible? Instead of giving up these people for execution, they decided to go to war with the other tribes. So now we have a great civil war in ancient Israel. Benjamin versus the other tribes, which is rather foolhardy for Benjamin, but the same thing comment could have been made, you know, regarding the North and South in many respects. The South was a bit overconfident when the Civil War began as well. But anyway, and all of you have been, many of you in your own countries or in history have read about civil wars. As I said, Spain had one recently. And, you know, there's countries even right now, even as I speak, where there's a tremendous amount of trouble within the countries, warfare within countries. It's still happening even now. So ancient Israel had a civil war between Benjamin and the other tribes. And God encouraged the Israelites to punish Benjamin for their wickedness. Benjamin did need to be punished. However, he didn't guarantee that this war would go easily. He didn't guarantee. First round, it's all over. You've won. And so even though God encouraged Benjamin and the Israelites to punish Benjamin, he didn't intervene in such a way that they won a victory immediately. They had to go out there, do their best, and their best wasn't good enough a couple of times. And the same thing happened in the American Civil War. Abraham Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, he looked upon that war as a punishment on the entire nation, and that both sides were suffering because of the sins of the nation, particularly the sin of slavery that was a national institution as far as that's concerned. But here we have, in effect, a punishment on the whole nation. But then the Israelites got their act together spiritually. They fasted, they prayed. If you read in the 20th chapter, which I'm encouraging you to read. In fact, you know, now that I think of it, I got a recent message. I want to tell you something. I've been encouraging you to read the Pentateuch this year. This is a sabbatical year, and in a sabbatical year, we should read the Pentateuch. And I gave out, my custom is to give out certificates to those who read the Pentateuch this year. And so there should be some certificates heading on out. I've been informed that one of our listeners, listen to this, not only has read the Pentateuch, but has written it all out. She wanted extra credit, I guess. So maybe we should put a gold star on her certificate. But anyway, so she'll be getting a certificate, I hope. And then somebody wrote to me today and said, I finished the Pentateuch. What's my next assignment? All right. Your next assignment is read Judges 20. So let it be written. So let it be done. Wise decision, noble task. You know, those are insider jokes from the Ten Commandment movie of Cecil B. DeMille. So anyway, but in the 20th chapter, not to make light of this, in the 20th chapter, we see that the third time when they got there, when they spiritually really developed, let's say, more of a spiritual attitude, God said, okay, this time you go out there, you're going to win. So finally, he promised them, you know, once they really developed a better relationship with him, he said, okay, the third time, you know, Phinehas said, you're going to win now. And they did. And they won dramatically. The Benjamite warriors were reduced to just 600 of them. And there were thousands of casualties on both sides. You can read about that in Judges 20. There were thousands of casualties on both sides. But finally, 600 Benjamites fled to an area that was a little more difficult to attack. I don't think they would have survived there, but at least they had a chance of holding out in that area where they fled, a place called Rimon. They called it Pomegranate Rock. I don't know why it was called Pomegranate Rock, but maybe the rock somehow reminded you of a pomegranate, whatever. It was called Pomegranate Rock, and they fled there. But the Israelites weren't interested in going any further than after those 600. But what they did is that they exterminated the entire tribe of Benjamin. Men, women, and children. Now, God didn't tell them to do that. Did they have to go that far? All of the tribe of Benjamin were exterminated, but those 600 warriors that had fled to Pomegranate Rock. That was all that was left. So now what happens? Now that they've done this, now they realize we've gone too far. We got out of control. We let our anger at our losses and our casualties and the wickedness of these Gibeonites, we let ourselves just get out of control. And we wiped out nearly an entire tribe. So now they're weeping about that. So now we go to Judges 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah. Again, God didn't ask them to do that. Rash oaths. You've got to be very careful about that. And this reminds me of a contemporary story. You might check it out. I think it's a true story. And the story goes like this. It's a contemporary story. It might be interesting to some of you. Some of you, again, are young. Most of you probably are young enough to remember the great peace between Israel and Egypt during the days of President Carter, when Carter was president, and Menachem Begin, the famous hawk, the famous right winger, was president of Israel, and Sadat, who had gone to war during Ramadan. The Ramadan has just ended. We're in a new month now. This is the fifth month on the sacred calendar. I'll say more about that in a moment. We're in the second day of the fifth month on the sacred calendar. The new moon was yesterday. But the war occurred in Ramadan on the Muslim calendar, and it was the Yom Kippur War on the Hebrew calendar, or the October War, 1973. And Sadat had waged it. And before that, he had waged what was known as the War of Attrition, which failed. And even the Yom Kippur War ultimately failed, but it did succeed in regaining Egyptian pride, Egyptian prestige. So it made it possible for now Sadat to negotiate. He did it, I think, mainly to just recover enough self-respect for the nation so that they could negotiate with the Israelis, which they later did. So they had these negotiations, and it led to a peace treaty, which still survives. The peace between Israel and Egypt. Well, the story goes, there was a beautiful new city the Jews had built. I remember during those years, they built a city called Yamit. Yam is the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. They built a city called Yamit, which was in territory that would have to go back to Egypt. Now, Menachem Begin, the hawk, had made an oath to God. And Jimmy Carter was a religious man. And so was Sadat, I suppose. So they understood this. Begin had made an oath to God. I will never surrender a Jewish settlement to the Arabs. Well, that was a rash oath because Yamit was in territory that had been seized from Egypt in the 67 war. But he made the oath. So the way they worked it out was the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, approved that part of the treaty. Rather than Begin officially saying, I hereby approve the surrender of Yamit, the Knesset did it. The Israeli parliament, so that he was able to technically hold to his oath. That's interesting, isn't it? So even in modern times, these kind of things come up. So please be careful. You know, you're not required to make an oath, so don't. You're not required to, generally speaking. Now, when you're in court, they tell you, you have to promise to tell the truth. But I mean, in general, you're not required to use that system of oaths, so don't. Anyway, now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. Well, now we got a problem. We got 600 virile men, and no women. What's going to happen to Benjamin? Then the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, O eternal God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? Well, the reason is because of sin. Obviously, moral decadence and war and all the rest of it. So it's kind of a rhetorical question in a way. They should have known the answer. So it was on the next morning. Well, actually, what they're saying is, what are we going to do about it? What a mess. How can we solve this problem is really what they're asking. So it was on the next morning that the people rose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly of the Eternal? For they had made a great oath. Here we go again. A great oath concerning anyone who had not come up to the Eternal at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. So they really had reacted to this. Now I understand righteous indignation is appropriate, but wow, they made an oath. No longer will our women marry Benjamites. And not only that, but anybody who hasn't participated in this, we're going to wipe them out. So they went overboard. Anyway, and the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives, for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Eternal that we will not give them our daughters as wives? And they said, What one is there among from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Eternal? And in fact, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh Gilead to the assembly. Oh, so I believe that that's more on the east, northeastern part of the heartland. I think that's even on the east bank of the Jordan. It's the half tribe part of among the territory, the half tribe of Manasseh, the eastern Manassites. I think that area now is the Golan Heights area. For when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead was there. So the congregation sent out their 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, "Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead," I'm in verse 10, "with the edge of the sword, including the women and children." Could you imagine? Exterminated another Israelite city. Not enough bloodshed, huh? "And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has not known a man intimately." So they saved the virgins so that they might present them to the Benjamites. So they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. See, they were not subject to the oath. Their families had sent no one to Mizpah. Their city had never taken the oath. Therefore, they were eligible to marry the Benjamites. You follow that reasoning? Right? Does everybody follow that? Uh-huh. They were eligible because nobody from their village, no representative from their village had agreed with that oath. So they were eligible to marry the Benjamites. So these 400 virgins, their destiny now was to become Benjamite women. And, you know, Manasseh is related to Benjamin. Manasseh is from, you know, one of the children of Joseph. So Joseph and Benjamin were descendants of Rachel. So they were close ethnically. Then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon and announced peace to them. So now finally there's reconciliation. As fortunately most civil wars do finally end. The Spanish Civil War ended. The American Civil War ended. So Benjamin came back at that time. And they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. Oh, there's still 200 men without wives. Everybody with me? 600 men had fled, had survived. 400 now had wives. Right? Doesn't it say that? There are 400 of them? And
verse 12 says,
verse 12. Okay, thank you. Audience participation, that's what I like. All right, so now we go to verse 15. "And the people grieved for Benjamin because the Eternal had made a void in the tribes of Israel." Well, he'd allowed it, but, you know, they didn't have to go as far as they went. But he had allowed it, you know, so that we could read about it now partly and get the lesson here that we do have to be very, very careful. You know, those of you who are paying attention, take a pencil, take a pen, take a crayon, chalk, lipstick, whatever you can write with. Take a paper. Draw an angle. Draw a 45-degree angle on your paper. A little one. There's a couple of lines. There's not much distance between those two lines to draw an angle. But now extend the lines. Look what happens as you extend the lines on your paper. The distance between the lines grows farther and farther, right? The 45-degree angle, as you extend the lines, there's just a little distance at first, and then the lines get farther and farther. So as you deviate from the norm, there's that slippery slope, and it gets worse and worse. And that's what's happening here. One problem leads to another. One rash vow leads to how do you fix these things? Well, when you get into trouble, when you get into a messy situation, you have to fix it with another messy situation. That's the way these things tend to go. So anyway, that's the story. So we go to verse 16. "Then the elders of the congregation said, 'What shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?' Then they said, 'There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel.'" They wanted these 600 men to all have the opportunity, you know, to have wives, to be fruitful and multiply, so the tribe would be rebuilt, which it was. "However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin.'" Then they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Eternal in Shiloh." Now, Shiloh is in the territory of Ephraim. So I would imagine a lot of the women who would have gone to that would be Ephraimites or Manassites, and they would be descendants of Joseph, closely related to Benjamin. And very likely, though, also there would have been Levites there, because Shiloh was a place where the tabernacle was. So therefore, there would have been Levitical women there. So that would be the ethnic mix of the women there, I would say. Then they said, in fact, there is a yearly feast of the Eternal in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, go, lie in wait in the vineyards. Now, evidently, I wouldn't be surprised if this story circulated around, because you see, it's a really dramatic story. I'm sure that a lot of you today have been interested in this story if you weren't very familiar with it, because it is, you know, it's something that really doesn't, attract your interest, and it may be in a negative sense, and, you know, it's a sad story, but it's quite interesting. And I would imagine it circulated around the Mediterranean. Maybe that's why later on in history, around 750 BC, we have the traditional rape of the Sabine women. It's featured in art in Western civilization. What happened was that the Roman soldiers took women from the Etruscans for their wives. I guess they forcibly took a group of women for their wives, and that became a very important legend, the so-called rape of the Sabine women. And evidently, eventually, there was a reconciliation with the Etruscans. And it worked out, you know, there was a peace later. And this whole story became the basis of an American musical. The rape of the Sabine women and then the reconciliation. It became a theme of an American musical, which also had a biblical theme to it too. And it was called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And in that musical, you see the biblical influence. There's this family where everybody was named with a biblical name in alphabetical order. I think there was Adam, Benjamin, Caleb. I don't know if it was Daniel or David. Daniel, right? Then who was the next guy? Ephraim or Elijah, whatever. And then finally, there was a guy whose name was Frank. His name was Frankincense, but he called his name Frank. So anyway, then the head brother of the group got a woman to marry him, and when she had a girl, she decided, well, I want to keep the alphabet going, so I guess they had come up to H. I don't know how they got to H. I don't know where the I and the no, H would be the eighth letter. Yeah, Frank was number seven, right? Yeah, yeah. So the next letter would have been H. So
there
she
was a Gideon.
I'm sorry, there was a Gideon. Gideon would have been number seven, right? Yeah. Frank, right? E would have, right? E Elijah was five. And the sixth would have been Frank, and seven would have been Gideon.
Yes.
All right. So the eighth one was now this girl, the daughter of the first brother. So she said, well, I'll name her Hannah or Hephzibah. Well, you could imagine the dad wanted Hannah. He didn't want her to be named Hephzibah. That's in the Bible as well. It's a nice meaning, but Hannah would be, you know, generally Americans would prefer Hannah. So he said, call her Hannah. So that, anyway. And so that movie had a biblical influence, but it also talked about in modern language, the taking of the wives. And then, you know, they figured out a way to work it out later and so on. Anyway, that's a fictional story, but this really happened. And it's really interesting that such a thing would happen. Here is a festival. Women are going out to dance, and these men are given permission to just grab a wife, you know, get out there, and while they're out there dancing, grab you a wife. And therefore, the men can't say we violated our vow because they didn't give you the wives, you took them. See what I'm saying? So technically, the vow was preserved. You know, it's very interesting. You know, talk about a legal technicality, a loophole. Okay, now when was this? Very likely it was the anniversary will be very soon. And this is where I'll pause and take a little bit of time to talk about the calendar. You know, yesterday was the new moon of the fifth month. This is a very sober time in the history of the church. Next week, Jews will be reading Isaiah 1, and the next day Orthodox Jews will be fasting and reading Lamentations. Next week on the Sabbath will be the ninth day of the fifth month, and the next day will be the tenth day of the fifth month. We look at Zechariah 8:19. Now, the point I wanted to make, though, is that after that very sober time, beginning with the 11th day, then we take comfort. And the next week after the ninth of Av is a week of comfort, and we look forward to the autumn festival days. From the 11th day of Av till the Festival of Trumpets is 50 days. So just like we have 50 days, you know, from Passover to Pentecost, beginning with Av 11, we have 50 days to the Festival of Trumpets. And that's a time of comfort. And so the week after Isaiah 1, Isaiah 40 is read, comfort ye my people. And on the 15th day of the fifth month, on the full moon of the fifth month, this is the beginning of the grape harvest. And this is a festival among Jews, the 15th of Av. The 9th and 10th are very, very sad days. But the 15th is a festival. And nowadays, it's the romantic holiday in Israel. It's more or less the time for lovers. It's the 15th day of the fifth month. Now, that might have been what the festival was here talked about when they were dancing around the vineyards. It may have been the 15th of Av at the beginning of the grape harvest. That's just speculation. But I think that's the Jewish tradition here on that. Anyway, let's go to what they said. Verse 20. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin. You see what happens when you begin to botch things up, you know, you have fixed them the best you can, and it's awkward at best. Put it that way, to use an understatement. This is an awkward way to solve the problem, right? But you know, what can you do? You made a vow, so this was their way of working it out. Verse 22, then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. All right, you know, you didn't do this. They came and grabbed them. So you're free. Verse 23, and the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So from those 600 men and women, over time, they were fruitful and multiplied, and over decades and centuries, the tribe of Benjamin was rebuilt, so that there was a tribe of Benjamin from, you know, this tribe. King Saul came from Benjamin, Saul and Jonathan, as Mordecai came from Benjamin, perhaps Esther, Paul came from Benjamin. Verse 24. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. So we have peace. But you see, the situation certainly is less than ideal. Okay? And that's how the summary is at the end of the book. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So in an age when standards are deteriorating, and we have all kinds of options, all kinds of permutations, combinations, perversions, we do need to stand firm and retain our relationship with God and with his word at a time like this, which is similar in some ways, as I said, to the time of the judges. We have to be very careful to not go with the flow. That's a very important lesson we can learn from these accounts in the book of Judges. I want to go to 1 Thessalonians 5. So please, first of all, keep your head, keep control, and think, and also pray. If an idea comes to mind, think about it, study the Bible, discuss it in a civil way with others, and discuss it with God. Pray about these ideas. Bring them before God as well as talking over it with others, but also bring it up in your prayer life. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. Test all things. hold fast what is good. So what you know what is right, hold fast, because people are going to want you to turn loose. Test all things, hold fast what is good. Abstain from every form of evil. Don't take for granted that what around us at present is the norm, the way things ought to be. No. The situation in Western civilization at present is not the way things ought to be, not the way things will ultimately be. Test all things, hold fast what is good, abstain from every form of evil. And if you feel that you need more wisdom, then go to God for it. James 1 and verse 5. And that means that God is going to give you an opportunity to make decisions. And don't palm off decisions necessarily on anybody else or even on God. God is wanting you to build character and make decisions. So he will guide and direct you, but he's not necessarily, you know, going to wake you up in the middle of the night and say, buy this house, not that house. He wants you to develop wisdom and be able to make decisions. He wants you to develop character. And look what he says in Psalm 37. Before I even go to James, I'm going to go way back to Psalm 37. I know your stomach is grumbling out on the West Coast, but hang in there. Psalm 37. And verse 4. What are your hopes and dreams? What do you really want to do? What's on your bucket list, as we say? Psalm 37, verse 4. Delight yourself also in the Eternal, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. What do you want? God wants to know what you want. Delight yourself also in the Eternal, he shall give you the desires of your heart. Now, obviously, if it's good for you, he has ultimate, you know, veto power. He's in control. But within his plan, you know, he wants you to have what you want. Let's go now to James 1 and verse 5. So if we lack wisdom, if we want to make better decisions, then we need to go to God for the wisdom. James 1 verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. So if you have a relationship with God, he's not going to turn you down if you ask for wisdom. He'll give it to you if you ask, if you have a right relationship with him. Now I want to conclude in Matthew the 24th chapter, prophecies about the end time. And notice what it says about that period of time in Matthew 24 and verse 12. And whether or not we're literally there, we are in such a time now in terms of the moral climate, I would say. Matthew 24 and verse 12. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But we can't be in that kind of situation. Verse 13. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Ministerial comments about a monumental conflict. And now, Q&A. How long was Jesus' public ministry? How long was Jesus' public ministry? Conservative scholars, I think, generally would agree it was a 3.5-year ministry. Well, by conservative scholars, I mean those who are not skeptical about the biblical account, who take the biblical account very respectfully and seriously. We know at least 3 Passovers in Jesus' ministry. There was probably a 4th. But let's take a look at 3 Passovers within his ministry. So that would give him at least, 2 years plus to have those 3 Passovers occur. And I'm contending for 3.5 years, but I want to go to John 2. And verse 13. John 2 and verse 13. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He had already begun his ministry at that point, but he goes to the Passover. Now I go to John 6. John verse 3, and Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. So now we have another Passover. There had been events in the between here. You could look at, there's John 4, there's John 5. John 5 talks about another feast. I have my theories on that one. There are, and the scholars do not agree on John 5:1 as to what that feast was. But John 6 is clear. It tells you what the feast was. John 6, verse 4. Now the Passover, feast of the Jews, was near. So now we have another Passover. And we all know that when he went to Jerusalem to be crucified, it was on the Passover. So let's go to John 11 and verse 55. John 11 and verse 55. And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. So we see at least three Passovers in his ministry, and I would contend that there was a fourth, that anyway, that altogether we have 3.5 years of his ministry. And I believe that he was fulfilling a prophecy in Daniel 9. I want to go to Daniel 9. And I'm going to look at Daniel 9 as the Greek-speaking Jews understood it and as the King James translates it. Daniel 9 and verse 24. The 70 weeks prophecy, which is clearly a messianic prophecy when you see the beginning of it. Daniel 9 verse 24. "70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy." I would call that a messianic prophecy. I would say that's pointing to Jesus Christ's ministry. Now let's go to verse 27. Remember, we're talking about 70 weeks of years. 70 weeks of years. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering." Well, let me just back off to the 26th verse, all right? Let me back up to the 26th verse. I'm shuffling around in here because I want to get the address for more questions. Okay, good, I have it. I don't know what it is. I get a brain freeze every Sabbath and forget the address. I can remember it, right? CCK153questions@gmail.org.
.com.
All right, .com. All right, I almost got it.
What?
All right, I'm going to try to do it without the notes when I finish. All right, anyway, verse 27. Let's go back to verse 26. "And after 62 weeks," so that's 62 weeks of years, "Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. And till the end of the war, desolations are determined." Well, we know that Jesus Christ was crucified, and then a generation later, Jerusalem was destroyed. People were scattered. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week." So at that time, when he's crucified, he's cut off in the middle. So it says that he's cut off. Well, how is he cut off? Well, it explains it in the next verse, that he's cut off in the middle of a seven-year ministry. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering." How? Well, a generation later, it was taken away and it has not been brought back. But that was to some degree a punishment for what they did. But also he brought an end to it in the sense of the system of obligatory sacrifices. With his sacrifice, that system of obligatory sacrifices came to an end. The new covenant does not have obligatory sacrifices. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate." So we know that in the end time there will be this abomination of desolation before his second coming, "even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate." So he will then return, and I think to finish the other 3.5 years. So Jesus Christ had a 3.5 year ministry. He was cut off in the middle of it. He brought an end to our obligation to bring sacrifices. He is our sacrifice. He was cut off not for himself, but for us. But he will return, and he will complete then a three and a half more years as he returns. The week will be completed with his return. This is what I believe. And it's interesting that in Revelation 11, as a prelude to the 3.5 year ministry of Jesus Christ when he returns, there's a 3.5 year ministry of two witnesses. I want to go to Revelation 11. and verse 3. Well, let's go to verse 2. But leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot 42 months, which is 3.5 years. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth, 3.5 years. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. And you know that when their ministry is completed, Jesus Christ returns. So there's a kind of a parallel ministry right before Jesus returns of 3.5 years. So this is what I'm contending, and I'll study the matter further and try to get into more of the technicalities of it if anybody wants to delve into it further or ask me further questions. But I would recommend back when many, many years ago, when I began to study the New Testament formally, I used a Harmony of the Gospels by A.T. Robertson. He was using the old King James translation, but I would say that's probably still available and still useful. A Harmony of the Gospels by A.T. Robertson. Also, there's an old Bible dictionary, Unger's, which has a Harmony of the Gospels in it. And I would imagine newer Bible dictionaries. I haven't checked the Zondervan dictionary. That's a more recent one. And there's, of course, I own a rather learned collection of volumes. I think it's called the Interpreter's Bible Dictionary. I could check into that as well. But what you could do is check various dictionaries and handbooks. And particularly, I would say, when it comes to the length of Jesus' ministry, I would lean particularly to those who really take seriously the actual biblical material, who are not skeptical about what the Bible actually says, who take it, you know, very seriously. And I personally believe he had a 3.5 year ministry. I believe I've shown some evidence for that today. And we can discuss it further if you care to do it, but I do appreciate the question. And I personally am looking forward to 3.5 more years for him to finish that week when he returns. In fact, I hope and pray to be a part of that. And I hope and pray that those of you who listen to me today will also be a part of that. In the meantime, all the best. Wait a minute. Before I finish, you can ask your questions, right, at ckk153questions@gmail.com.
You can also request your website.
And also we have, what, a Facebook page. I'm going to post something on that page soon. I'm going to post recommendations for seasonal readings during this very serious time of year as we approach the 9th and 10th of Av. So I'm going to recommend certain readings, which I already have done in terms of the last couple messages. You know, you heard me make recommendations last week and talk this week as well about Isaiah 1. And Lamentations, you know, so those of you who've been listening have heard the recommendations, but I'm also going to post them. So in the meantime, all the best to you and yours.